Chapter 4 The Slow Mutants 1 The gunslinger spoke slowly to Jake in the rising and falling inflections of one who speaks in his sleep. There were three of us that night. Cuthbert, Alan, and me. We weren't supposed to be there because none of us had passed from the time of children. We were still in our clouts, as the saying went. If we'd been caught, court would have striped us bloody. But we weren't. I don't think any of the ones that went before us were caught either. Boys must put on their father's pants in private, strut them in front of the mirror, and then sneak them back on their hangers. It was like that. The father pretends he doesn't notice the new way the pants are hung up, or the traces of boot polish mustaches still under their noses. Do you see? The boy said nothing. He'd said nothing since they had passed from the daylight. The gunslinger, on the other hand, had talked hectically, feverishly, to fill the silence. He had not looked back at the light as they passed into the land beneath the mountains, but the boy had. The gunslinger had read the failing of day in the soft mirror of Jake's cheek. Now faint rose, now milk glass, now pallid silver, now the last dusk glow touch of evening. Now, nothing. The gunslinger had struck a false light, and they had gone on. Finally, they camped. No echo from the man in black returned to them. Perhaps he had stopped to rest, too. Or perhaps he floated onward and without running lights through nighted chambers. The sowing night cotillion, the Kamala, some of the older folk called it, after the word for rice, was held once a year in the Western Hall. The gunslinger went on. The proper name was the Hall of Grandfathers, but to us it was only the Western Hall. The sound of dripping water came to their ears. A courting rite, as any spring dance surely is. The gunslinger laughed deprecatingly. The insensate walls turned the sound into a loon-like wheeze. In the old days, the books say it was the welcoming of spring, what was sometimes called New Earth or Fresh Kamala, but civilization, you know. He trailed off, unable to describe the change inherent in that featureless noun, the death of romance and the lingering of its sterile, carnal revenant, a world living on the forced respiration of glitter and ceremony. The geometric steps of make-believe courtship during the sowing night cotill that had replaced the truer, madder scribble-scrabble of love which he could only intuit dimly. Hollow grandeur in place of true passions which might once have built kingdoms and sustained them. He found the truth with Susan Delgado and Magis, only to lose it again. Once there was a king, he might have told the boy. The eld, whose blood, attenuated though it may be, still flows in my veins. But kings are done, lad. In the world of light, anyway. They made something decadent out of it, the gunslinger said at last. A play. A game. In his voice was all the unconscious distaste of the ascetic and the eremite. His face, had there been stronger light to illumine it, would have shown harshness and sorrow, the purest kind of condemnation. His essential force had not been cut or diluted by the passage of years. The lack of imagination that still remained in that face was remarkable. But the ball, the gunslinger said, the sowing night cotill. The boy did not speak, did not ask. There were crystal chandeliers, heavy glass with electric sparklights. It was all light. It was an island of light. We sneaked into one of the old balconies, the ones that were supposed to be unsafe and roped off. But we were boys. And boys will be boys, so they will. To us, everything was dangerous, but what of that? Had we not been made to live forever? We thought so, even when we spoke to each other of our glorious deaths. We were above everyone and could look down on everything. I don't remember that any of us said anything. We only drank it up with our eyes. There was a great stone table where the gunslingers and their women sat at meat, watching the dancers. A few of the gunslingers also danced, but only a few. And they were the young ones. The one who sprang the trap on Hax was one of the dancers, I seem to recall. The elders only sat, and it seemed to me they were half embarrassed in all that light, all that civilized light. They were revered ones, the feared ones, the guardians. But they seemed like hostlers in that crowd of cavaliers with their soft women. There were four circular tables loaded with food, and they turned all the time. The cook's boys never stopped coming and going from 7 until 3 o'clock the next morning. The tables were like clocks, and we could smell roast pork, beef, lobster, chickens, baked apples. The odors changed as the tables turned. There were ices and candies. There were great flaming skewers of meat. Martin sat next to my mother and father. I knew them even from so high above, and once she and Martin danced, slowly and revolvingly, and the others cleared the floor for them and clapped when it was over. The gunslingers did not clap, but my father stood slowly and held his hands out to her. And she went to him, smiling, holding out her own. It was a moment of enormous gravity. Even we felt it in our high hiding place. My father had by then taken control of his quartet, you must ken, the tet of the gun, and was on the verge of becoming Dean of Gilead, if not all in-world. The rest knew it. Martin knew it better than any. Except, perhaps, for Gabrielle Veris, that was. The boy spoke at last, and with seeming reluctance.
She was your mother?
Aye. Gabrielle of the Waters, daughter of Alan, wife of Stephen, mother of Roland. The gunslinger spread his hands apart in a mocking little gesture that seemed to say, "Here I am, and what of it?" Then he dropped them into his lap again. My father was the last Lord of Light. The gunslinger looked down at his hands. The boy said nothing more. "I remember how they danced," the gunslinger said. "My mother and Martin, the gunslinger's counselor. I remember how they danced, revolving slowly together and apart in the old steps of courtship." He looked at the boy, smiling. But it meant nothing, you know, because power had been passed in some way that none of them knew but all understood, and my mother was grown root and branch to the holder and wielder of that power. Was it not so? She went to him when the dance was over, didn't she? And clasped his hands. Did they applaud? Did the hall ring with it as those pretty boys and their soft ladies applauded and lauded him? Did it? Did it? Bitter water dripped distantly in the darkness. The boy said nothing. "I remember how they danced," the gunslinger said softly. "I remember how they danced." He looked up at the unseeable stone roof, and it seemed for a moment that he might scream at it, rail at it, challenge it blindly. Those blind and tongueless tonnages of granite that now bore their tiny lives like microbes in its stone intestine. What hand could have held the knife that did my father to his death?
"I'm tired," the boy said, and then again said no more.
The gunslinger lapsed into silence, and the boy laid over and put one hand between his cheek and the stone. The little flame in front of them guttered. The gunslinger rolled a smoke. It seemed he could see the crystal light still in the eye of his memory, hear the shout of accolade, empty in a husked land that stood even then hopeless against a gray ocean of time. Remembering that island of light hurt him bitterly, and he wished he had never held witness to it, or to his father's cuckoldry.
He passed smoke between his mouth and nostrils, looking down at the boy. "How we make large circles in earth for ourselves," he thought. "Around we go, back to the start, and the start is there again, resumption, which was ever the curse of daylight. How long before we see daylight again?" He slept. After the sound of his breathing had become long and steady and regular, the boy opened his eyes and looked at the gunslinger with an expression of sickness and love. The last light of the fire caught in one pupil for a moment and was drowned there. He went to sleep. Two. The gunslinger had lost most of his time sense in the desert, which was changeless. He lost the rest of it here in the passage under the mountains, which was lightless. Neither of them had any means of telling the clock, and the concept of hours became meaningless, abnegated. In a sense, they stood outside of time. A day might have been a week, or a week a day. They walked, they slept, they ate thin meals that did not satisfy their bellies. Their only companion was a steady, thundering rush of the water, drilling its auger path through the stone. They followed it, and drank from its flat, mineral-salted depth, hoping there was nothing in it that would make them sick or kill them. At times the gunslinger thought he saw fugitive drifting lights like corpse lamps beneath its surface, but supposed they were only projections of his brain, which had not forgotten the light. Still, he cautioned the boy not to put his feet in the water. The rangefinder in his head took them on steadily. The path beside the river, for it was a path, smooth, sunken to a slight concavity, led always upward toward the river's head. At regular intervals they came to curved stone pylons with sunken ring bolts. Perhaps once oxen or stage horses had been tethered there. At each was a steel flagon holding an electric torch, but these were all barren of life and light. During the third period of rest before sleep, the boy wandered away a little. The gunslinger could hear small conversations of rattled pebbles as Jake moved cautiously. "Careful," he said. "You can't see where you are."
"I'm crawling. It's... say."
"What is it?" The gunslinger half crouched, touching the haft of one gun. There was a slight pause. The gunslinger strained his eyes uselessly.
"I think it's a railroad," the boy said dubiously.
The gunslinger got up and walked toward the sound of Jake's voice, leading with one foot lightly to test for pitfalls.
"Here."
A hand reached out and cat's-pawed the gunslinger's face. The boy was very good in the dark, better than Roland himself. His eyes seemed to dilate until there was no color left in them. The gunslinger saw this as he struck a meager light. There was no fuel in this rock womb, and what they had brought with them was going rapidly to ash. At times the urge to strike a light was well nigh insatiable. They had discovered one could grow as hungry for light as for food. The boy was standing beside a curved rock wall that was lined with parallel metal staves running off into the darkness. Each carried black nodes that might once have been conductors of electricity. And beside and below, set only inches off the stone floor, were tracks of bright metal. What might have run on those tracks at one time? The gunslinger could only imagine sleek electric bullets firing their courses through this forever night with affrighted searchlight eyes going before. He had never heard of such things, but there were many remnants of the gone world, just as there were demons. The gunslinger had once come upon a hermit who'd gained a quasi-religious power over a miserable flock of kine, keepers by possession of an ancient gasoline pump. The hermit crouched beside it, one arm wrapped possessively around it, and preached wild, guttering sermons. He occasionally placed the still bright steel nozzle, which was attached to a rotted rubber hose, between his legs. On the pump, In perfectly legible, although rust-clotted letters, was a legend of unknown meaning. Emeco. Lead-free. Emeco had become the totem of a thunder god, and they had worshipped him with the slaughter of sheep and the sound of engines. Rum, 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 rum. Hulks, the gunslinger thought. Only meaningless hulks poking from sands that once were seas. And now a railroad. We'll follow it, he said. The boy said nothing. The gunslinger extinguished the light, and they slept. When Roland awoke, the boy was up before him, sitting on one of the rails and watching him sightlessly in the dark. They followed the rails like blind men, Roland leading, Jake following. They slipped their feet along one rail always, also like blind men. The steady rush of the river off to the right was their companion. They did not speak, and this went on for three periods of waking. The gunslinger felt no urge to think coherently or to plan. His sleep was dreamless. During the fourth period of waking and walking, they literally stumbled on a handcar. The gunslinger ran into it chest high, and the boy, walking on the other side, struck his forehead and went down with a cry. The gunslinger made a light immediately. "Are you all right?" The words sounded sharp, angry, and he winced at them. "Yes." The boy was holding his head gingerly. He shook it once to make sure he had told the truth. They turned to look at what they had run into. It was a flat, square plate of metal that sat mutely on the tracks. There was a seesaw handle in the center of the square. It descended into a connection of cogs. The gunslinger had no immediate sense of the thing's purpose, but the boy grasped it at once. "It's a handcar." "What?" "Handcar," the boy said impatiently, "like in the old cartoons, look." He pulled himself up and went to the handle. He managed to push it down, but it took all his weight hung over the handle to turn the trick. The handcar moved a foot with silent timelessness on the rails.
"Good,"
said a faint mechanical voice. It made them both jump.
"Good. Push a—"
The mechanical voice died out.
"It works a little hard,"
the boy said, as if apologizing for the thing. The gunslinger pulled himself up beside Jake and shoved the handle down. The handcar moved forward obediently, then stopped.
"Good. Push again,"
the mechanical voice encouraged. He had felt a drive shaft turn beneath his feet. The operation pleased him, and so did the mechanical voice, although he intended to listen to that no longer than necessary. Other than the pump at the way station, this was the first machine he'd seen in years that still worked well. But the thing disquieted him, too. It would take them to their destination that much the quicker. He had no doubt whatever that the man in black had meant for them to find this, too.
"Neat, huh?" the boy said, and his voice was full of loathing.
The silence was deep. Roland could hear his organs at work inside his body, and the drip of water, and nothing else.
"You stand on one side, I stand on the other," Jake said. "You'll have to push by yourself until it gets rolling. Good, then I can help. First you push, then I push. We'll go right along, get it?"
"I get it," the gunslinger said. His hands were in helpless, despairing fists.
"But you'll have to push by yourself until it gets rolling good," the boy repeated, looking at him.
The gunslinger had a sudden, vivid picture of the great hall a year or so after the sewing night cotillion. By then it had been nothing but shattered shards in the wake of revolt, civil strife, and invasion. This image was followed by one of Allie, the scarred woman from Tull, pushed and pulled by bullets that were killing her for no reason at all, unless reflex was a reason. Next came Cuthbert Allgood's face, laughing as he went downhill to his death, still blowing that god's damned horn. And then he saw Susan's face, twisted, made ugly with weeping. "All my old friends," the gunslinger thought, and smiled hideously.
"I'll push," the gunslinger said.
He began to push, and when the voice began to speak,
"Good, push again, good, push again,"
He sent his hand fumbling along the post upon which the seesaw handle had been balanced. At last he found what he was surely looking for, a button. He pushed it.
"Goodbye, pal,"
the mechanical voice said cheerily, and was then blessedly silent for some hours. 3. They rolled on through the dark, faster now, no longer having to feel their way. The mechanical voice spoke up once, suggesting they eat crisp a la, and again to say that nothing satisfied at the end of a hard day like larches. Following this second piece of advice, it spoke no more. Once the awkwardness of a buried age had been run off the handcar, it went smoothly. The boy tried to do his share, and the gunslinger allowed him small shifts, but mostly he pumped by himself in large and chest-stretching risings and fallings. The underground river was their companion, sometimes closer on their right, sometimes further away. Once it took on huge and thunderous hollowness, as if passing through some great cathedral narthex. Once the sound of it disappeared almost altogether. The speed and the made wind against their faces seemed to take the place of sight and to drop them once again into a frame of time. The gunslinger estimated they were making anywhere from 10 to 15 miles an hour, always on a shallow, almost imperceptible uphill grade that wore him out deceptively. When they stopped, he slept like the stone itself. Their food was almost gone again. Neither of them worried about it. For the gunslinger, the tenseness of a coming climax was as imperceivable but as real and accretive as the fatigue of propelling the handcar. They were close to the end of the beginning. Or at least, he was. He felt like a performer placed on center stage minutes before the rise of the curtain. Settled in position, with his first line held securely in his mind, he heard the unseen audience rattling programs and settling in their seats. He lived with a tight, tidy ball of unholy anticipation in his belly and welcomed the exercise that let him sleep. And when he did sleep, it was like the dead. The boy spoke less and less. But at their stopping place, one sleep period not long before they were attacked by the slow mutants, he asked the gunslinger almost shyly about his coming of age.
"For I would hear more of that,"
he said. The gunslinger had been leaning with his back against the handle, a cigarette from his dwindling supply of tobacco clamped in his lips. He'd been on the verge of his usual unthinking sleep when the boy asked his question. "Why would thee sill to know that?" he asked, amused. The boy's voice was curiously stubborn, as if hiding embarrassment.
"I just would."
And after a pause he added,
"I always wondered about growing up. I bet it's mostly lies."
"What you'd hear of wasn't my growing up," the gunslinger said. "I suppose I did the first of that not long after what thee'd hear of."
"When you fought your teacher," Jake said remotely. "That's what I want to hear."
Roland nodded. "Yes, of course. The day he had tried the line. That was a story any boy might want to hear, all right. My real growing up didn't start until after my Da sent me away. I finished doing it at one place and another along the way." He paused. "I saw a not man hung once."
"A not man? I don't understand."
"You could feel him but couldn't see him." Jake nodded, seeming to understand.
"He was invisible."
Roland raised his eyebrows. He had never heard the word before. "Do you say so?"
"Yes."
"Then let it be so. In any case, there were folk who didn't want me to do it. Felt they'd be cursed if I did it, but the fellow had gotten a taste for rape. Do you know what that is?"
"Yes," Jake said. "And I bet an invisible guy would be good at it, too. How did you catch him?"
"That's a tale for another day." Knowing there would be no other days. Both of them knowing there would be no others. 2 years after that, I left a girl in a place called Kingstown. Although I didn't want to.
Sure you did,
the boy said, and the contempt in his voice was no less for the softness of his tone.
Got to catch up with that tower, am I right? Got to keep a-ridin', just like the cowboys on my dad's network.
Roland felt his face flush with heat in the dark, but when he spoke, his voice was even. That was the last part, I guess. Of my growing up, I mean. I never knew any of the parts when they happened. Only later did I know that. He realized with some unease that he was avoiding what the boy wanted to hear. I suppose the coming of age was part of it, at that, he said, almost grudgingly. It was formal, almost stylized. Like a dance. He laughed unpleasantly. The boy said nothing. It was necessary to prove one's self in battle. The gunslinger began. 4. Summer and hot. Full Earth had come to the land like a vampire lover that year, killing the land and the crops of the tenant farmers, turning the fields of the castle city of Gilead white and sterile. In the west, some miles distant and near the borders that were the end of the civilized world, fighting had already begun. All reports were bad, and all of them paled to insignificance before the heat that rested over this place of the center. Cattle lolled empty-eyed in the pens of the stockyards. Pigs grunted lustlessly, unmindful of sows and sex and knives whetted for the coming fall. People whined about taxes and conscription, as they always did. But there was an apathy beneath the empty passion play of politics. The center had frayed like a rag rug that had been washed and walked on and shaken and hung and dried. The thread that held the last jewel at the breast of the world was unraveling. Things were not holding together. The earth drew in its breath in the summer of the coming eclipse. The boy idled along the upper corridor of this stone place which was home, sensing these things, not understanding. He was also dangerous and empty, waiting to be filled. It was 3 years since the hanging of the cook who had always been able to find snacks for hungry boys. Roland had lengthened and filled out both at shoulder and hip. Now, dressed only in faded denim pants, 14 years old, he had come to look like the man he would become, lean and lank and quick on his feet. He was still unbedded, but two of the younger slatterns of a West Town merchant had cast eyes on him. He had felt a response, and felt it more strongly now. Even in the coolness of the passage, he felt sweat on his body. Ahead were his mother's apartments, and he approached them incuriously, meaning only to pass them and go upward to the roof, where a thin breeze and the pleasure of his hand awaited. He had passed the door when a voice called him, "You, boy!" It was Martin, the counselor. He was dressed with a suspicious, upsetting casualness, black whipcord trousers almost as tight as leotards, and a white shirt open halfway down his hairless chest. His hair was tousled. The boy looked at him silently. "Come in. Come in. Don't stand in the hall. Your mother wants to speak to you." He was smiling with his mouth, but the lines of his face held a deeper, more sardonic humor. Beneath that, and in his eyes, there was only coldness. In truth, his mother did not seem to want to see him. She sat in the low-backed chair by the large window in the central parlor of her apartments, the one which overlooked the hot blank stone of the central courtyard. She was dressed in a loose, informal gown that kept slipping from one white shoulder and looked at the boy only once. A quick, glinting, rueful smile, like autumn sun on a rill of water. During the interview which followed, she studied her hands rather than her son. He saw her seldom now, and the phantom of cradle songs, "Chusset, chisset, chasset," had almost faded from his brain. But she was a beloved stranger. He felt an amorphous fear, and an inchoate hatred for Martin, his father's closest adviser, was born. "Are you Elro?" she asked him softly. Martin stood beside her, a heavy, disturbing hand near the juncture of her white shoulder and white neck, smiling on them both. His brown eyes were dark to the point of blackness with smiling.
"Yes," he said. "Your studies go well? Lena is pleased? And Court?"
Her mouth quirked at this second name as if she had tasted something bitter.
"I'm trying," he said.
They both knew he was not flashingly intelligent like Cuthbert, or even quick like Jamie. He was a plodder and a bludgeoner. Even Alan was better at studies.
"And David?"
She knew his affection for the hawk. The boy looked up at Martin, still smiling paternally down on all this.
"Past his prime."
His mother seemed to wince. For a moment, Martin's face seemed to darken, his grip on her shoulder to tighten. Then she looked out into the hot whiteness of the day, and all was as it had been.
"It's a charade," he thought, "a game. Who is playing with whom?"
"You have a cut on your forehead," Martin said, still smiling, and pointed a negligent finger at the mark of Court's latest, "Thank you for this instructive day," bashing. "Are you going to be a fighter like your father, or are you just slow?"
This time she did wince.
"Both,"
the boy said. He looked steadily at Martin and smiled painfully. Even in here it was very hot. Martin stopped smiling abruptly.
"You can go to the roof now, boy. I believe you have business there."
"My mother has not yet dismissed me, bondsman."
Martin's face twisted as if the boy had lashed him with a quirt. The boy heard his mother's dreadful, woeful gasp. She spoke his name, but the painful smile remained intact on the boy's face, and he stepped forward.
"Will you give me a sign of fealty, bondsman, in the name of my father whom you serve?"
Martin stared at him, rankly unbelieving.
"Go," Martin said gently. "Go and find your hand."
Smiling rather horribly, the boy went. As he closed the door and went back the way he came, he heard his mother wail. It was a banshee sound. And then, unbelievably, the sound of his father's man striking her and telling her to shut her quack. To shut her quack! And then he heard Martin's laugh. The boy continued to smile as he went to his test. Five. Jamie had come from the shops, and when he saw the boy crossing the exercise yard, he ran to tell Roland the latest gossip of bloodshed and revolt to the west. But he fell aside, the words all unspoken. They had known each other since the time of infancy, and as boys they had dared each other, cuffed each other, and made a thousand explorations of the walls within which they had both been birthed. The boy strode past him, staring without seeing, grinning his painful grin. He was walking toward Court's cottage, where the shades were drawn to ward off the savage afternoon heat. Court napped in the afternoon so that he could enjoy to the fullest extent his evening tomcat forays into the mazed and filthy brothels of the lower town. Jamie knew in a flash of intuition, knew what was to come, and in his fear and ecstasy he was torn between following Roland and going after the others. Then his hypnotism was broken, and he ran toward the main buildings, screaming, "Cuthbert! Alan! Thomas!" His screams sounded puny and thin in the heat. They had known, all of them, in that intuitive way boys have, that Roland would be the first of them to try the line. But this was too soon. The hideous grin on Roland's face galvanized him as no news of wars, revolts, and witchcrafts could have done. This was more than words from a toothless mouth given over fly-specked heads of lettuce. Roland walked to the cottage of his teacher and kicked the door open. It slammed backward, hit the plain rough plaster of the wall, and rebounded. He had never been inside before. The entrance opened on an austere kitchen that was cool and brown, a table, two straight chairs, two cabinets. A faded linoleum floor tracked in black paths from the cooler set in the floor to the counter where knives hung and to the table. Here was a public man's privacy, the faded refuge of a violent midnight carouser who had loved the boys of three generations, roughly, and made some of them into gunslingers. "Court!" He kicked the table, sending it across the room and into the counter. Knives from the wall rack fell in twinkling jackstraws. There was a thick stirring in the other room, a half-sleep clearing of the throat. The boy did not enter, knowing it was sham, knowing that Court had awakened immediately in the cottage's other room, and stood with one glittering eye beside the door, waiting to break the intruder's unwary neck. "Court, I want you, bondsman!" Now he spoke the high speech, and Court swung the door open. He was dressed in thin underwear shorts, a squat man with bow legs, runneled with scars from top to toe, thick with twists of muscle. There was a round, bulging belly. The boy knew from experience that it was spring steel. The one good eye glared at him from the bashed and dented hairless head. The boy saluted formally. "Teach me no more, bondsman. Today I teach you."
"You are early, Puler,"
Court said casually, but he also spoke the high speech.
2 years early at the very best, I should judge. I will ask only once. Will you cry off?"
The boy only smiled his hideous, painful smile. For Court, who had seen the smile on a score of bloodied, scarlet-skied fields of honor and dishonor, it was answer enough, perhaps the only answer he would have believed.
"It's too bad," the teacher said absently. "You have been a most promising pupil, the best in 24 years, I should say. It will be sad to see you broken and set upon a blind path, but the world has moved on. Bad times are on horseback."
The boy still did not speak, and would have been incapable of any coherent explanation had it been required, but for the first time the awful smile softened a little.
"Still there is the line of blood," Court said. "Revolt and witchcraft to the west or no, I am your bondsman, boy. I recognize your command and bow to it now, if never again, with all my heart."
And Court, who had cuffed him, kicked him, bled him, cursed him, made mock of him, and called him the very eye of syphilis, bent to one knee and bowed his head. The boy touched the leathery, vulnerable flesh of his neck with wonder.
"Rise, bondsman, in love."
Court stood slowly, and there might have been pain behind the impassive mask of his reamed features.
"This is waste. Cry off, you foolish boy. I break my own oath. Cry off and wait."
The boy said nothing.
"Very well. If you say so, let it be so."
Court's voice became dry and businesslike.
"1 hour, and the weapon of your choice."
"You will bring your stick?"
"I always have."
"How many sticks have been taken from you, Court?" Which was tantamount to asking how many boys have entered the square yard beyond the great hall and returned as gunslinger apprentices.
"No stick will be taken from me today,"
Court said slowly.
"I regret it. There is only the once, boy. The penalty for over-eagerness is the same as the penalty for unworthiness. Can you not wait?"
The boy recalled Martin standing over him, the smile, and the sound of a blow from behind the closed door.
"No."
"Very well. What weapon do you choose?"
The boy said nothing. Court's smile showed a jagged ring of teeth.
"Wise enough to begin. In 1 hour, you realize you will in all probability never see your father, your mother, or your cobabbies again.
I know what exile means, Roland said softly.
Go now, and meditate on your father's face. Much good will it do you.
The boy went, without looking back.